Hi, everyone. I'm a local postdoc here. I'm also, well, for this month, actually, I'm moving to Station Q very soon. So today I'm going to tell you something about a specific strongly correlated metal model built from the SYK model. And first, I would like to thank my collaborators, Xue Yang So, who was an amazing undergrad student when we started doing all these. And she's now just become a grad student in Harvard University. And Leon Babbins is our professor here. This is the reference. Right. Oh, where is it? Steady. Probably fine. Yeah, maybe it was just... Yeah, thank you. Yeah, so speaking of correlated metals, I mean, it's not a strictly defined object. You can have your favorite poster child for the correlated metals, if it will. But a commonly... a very common scenario for a correlated metal is that, if you go to really low temperature, there is a highly renormalized, very heavy Fermi liquid. Well, especially when you're below a certain coherence scale. But if you're above that scale, quasiparticle will just vanish, and the description becomes a pretty complicated. Why is it doing that? Maybe let me just switch to another one. It seems better. Yeah. Okay. So, this is what usually happens. And, when we speak of materials where these things do happen, we are often thinking of cuprates, heavy fermion system, or etc. If you have any theoretical description, one of the very frequently encountered situation many people consider is to couple a Fermi surface to a quantum critical point. So we have something like that. At zero temperature, you have some quantum critical point. It's coupled to the Fermi surface. And right above the quantum critical point, in this critical fan here, you have some non-Fermi liquid. And right in here, if you lower the temperature, then you actually go from a non-Fermi liquid to a Fermi liquid. So that basically kind of repeats this scenario. This is nice, although the analysis of such a system in this situation is often pretty complicated. You have to devise very, very intricate diagrammatics to actually understand what's going on. Better understood, this part is maybe better understanding, but this crossover is even more complicated because you have to go from a regime where there's no quasiparticle to a regime where quasiparticles start to become more long-lived than it was. So, this is a pretty complicated problem. As physicists, we often try to find, simple ways to tackle these problems. It's like, when we study cows, if cows are just too complicated, we'll just go ahead to find the spherical one and target them first. So for us, we're going to build our spherical cow using this SYK model. So this SYK model is very different from what I introduced previously. At the first sight, it's just very different. But the merit of it is that it's exactly solvable. So what the SYK model is, it was first developed by or introduced by S and Y, Sachdev and Ye, and then it was later modified by Kitaev. So it's actually a quantum dot problem at 0 plus 1b with n fermion modes on this quantum dot, and just consider Q fermion random all-to-all interactions. This sounds pretty complicated, but if you say that I pick Q to 2 to become 2, then it just means SYK2 model. It's random all-to-all 2 fermion interaction. So that just means that you have random hoppings between any of the two modes, and then you have these this random matrix elements between them. But the SYK4 model is another one that people often study. And pretty much this is the one that got us all very interested in SYK model. So that you have every term is a full fermion term to C daggers and to C's. And then it's among all possible choices of four fermion modes, and you have a random interaction between them. These random couplings are all just Gaussian random variables. So these are the simplest versions of the SYK model that we frequently study or look at. Okay.
There is no reference to real space, but you call it quantum dot so that you can be more comfortable about all-to-all interactions. Is that why you're calling it quantum dot?
No. So here there's just no concept of space. There are just like so many modes, like n modes, and also I eventually going to take n to be infinity. So I better call it a zero plus 1D system, which is presumably just a dot, like a quantum dot. Okay. Yeah, so why is it interesting? I mean, we can look at the SYK2 model first. Well, this is just pretty simple. You can solve it if you fix like any of the TIJ configuration. It's just a matrix cyclization problem. And then you can say that, I mean, for each fixed T at least, it's a pretty good Fermi liquid in the sense that, okay, so you have this level. There's many levels that you get from T. In fact, it's actually satisfies semicircle law. And then, of course, since this model is free, non-interacting, so it has a very well-defined Fermi level, and it actually has a finite density of state near the Fermi level. And if you look at the thermodynamics coproperty, it looks like a Fermi liquid, as in, you know, it has like zero. It has a linear T heat capacity at low T, and then it has like no. Well, yeah, its entropy also behaves as if it's just a Fermi liquid. Although, I mean, this is a 0 plus 1D system, so there's no transport to talk about whatsoever. But we got to build on that. This, we don't have to call it an SYK model. This is just a random matrix model people have been studying, like, you know, throughout the years. People studied this like a long time ago. But the SYK4 model is much more complicated. It has this crazy full fermion term with all possible choices of full fermions and a random coupling between them. I mean, of course, there's just basically no hope if we want to solve it like for each fixed couplings U, unlike in here. But amazingly, if you take n to be large enough, number of fermion modes, remember this n is large enough, you actually can get an analytical solution. I'll get to that analytical solution later, but let me just tell you maybe the necessary thing to appreciate how exotic this model is. So at the large n limit, you can get an exact solution. It turns out to be an incoherent metal, as in it doesn't have any quasi-particle, unlike in here. And then, in fact, it's an example of what's called a CFT1. It's a conformal critical point. It has conformal symmetry, even at 0 plus 1 dimension, which is already quite exotic. And if you look at the Green's function, for example, CI, CJ dagger, this thing has a delta function. So the fermion only propagates along the time direction, but within, it's localized on a site. It never goes to the other site. Other mode. And then it has this funny power law behavior. So that's kind of a sign of a conformal invariance. If you look at the self-energy, it has this funny scaling, square root of omega. That is also why we called it. Well, it definitely doesn't have a well-defined pole, and then hence there's no quasi-particle description of it. That's why we called it an incoherent metal. And another very funny thing about this model is that if you go ahead to understand its try to calculate its entropy, it actually has a finite zero temperature entropy, as in finite as in something proportional to the number of modes, which is quite unusual, and you would say that maybe this is even violating the third law of thermodynamics. But this is actually, you can think of it as an artifact of the large n limit, as in now we are doing a limit where n goes to infinity first, and then the beta. So if you actually do it the other order, you wouldn't get a finite entropy. But the large n limit is what makes this model interesting.
Is that also for SYK2?
No, for SYK2 it never happens because we have a fixed set of levels and they are just free. You just fill it up. There's no ground state entropy at all.
Excuse me. Are these results sensitive to the filling? What's assumed about the filling?
Yeah. So for example, these statements are like quantitative. I mean, so this statement is always true if you have finite filling. Of course, if you just make the charge density like, you know, one, like one electron per site, this entropy just goes to zero, but smoothly, as a smooth function of the chemical potential.
Yeah. But the power law remains 1/2.
The power law remains 1/2, but you have to take it, there's some care needed to recover this, as in you don't want to keep the chemical potential fixed, as in you want to, in fact, you want to keep the charge density fixed. If you keep that fixed, you still get this power law. Yeah. But if you keep the chemical potential fixed at low temperature, it will just deplete all the modes or let all the modes get occupied. That's a different limit. Yes? Okay.
So this is how filling when you say chemical potential is zero?
Right. So, I mean, most of this result you can get very easily at half filling, but many of the statements also work at finite filling. As in, you can ask for S1K model with finite charge density. You state this qualitative statement never going to change. But of course, there are some prefactor and how big the entropy is. I mean, those will depend smoothly on the charge density.
Just one point, so when you say finite zero temperature entropy, so if I take the derivative of fixed n, and to be not infinite,
yes.
Then I go to zero temperature, and then I'll do it.
You would definitely avoid this situation if you do that limit. This is sort of an artifact if you take the large n limit first. That just basically means that the energy spacing as a function of n is particularly small. So when you take large n limit, there are a lot of modes collapsing onto the zero energy manifold, and then if you start to take the low temperature limit, after you take the large n limit, you would discover this very large so-called zero temperature entropy. But yeah, if you keep a finite n and go to zero temperature, you wouldn't be able to see this. Okay? All right? Yes. Okay, so those are interesting. Well, these are the perks of this model is that it's analytically solvable, but I mean, what can we do? This is just a 0 plus 1D model. You can do nothing about it. In particular, when we talk about metals, one thing we really care about is how the transport property goes. I mean, this is a 0 plus 1D model, so it's not very useful in terms of building not really useful to use these models to construct something with any transport. Well, naively speaking, but definitely, people are trying to do that, to make a real metal out of these things. The way to do it is that you have to have some sense of spatial dimension, of course. And so the way to do it is that, for example, following this work, you can say that I have an array of SYK quantum dots. You can put it in any dimension you want. I'm just drawing a one-dimensional lattice of SYK dot. Each dot has like n fermion modes in it. But you can do such an array in any dimension. So you want each dot to have this SYK4, like an intra dot coupling, that basically gives you most of the physics of the SYK4 incoherent metal that I just introduced. And now you want to have some transport, so you want these dots to talk to each other. A most convenient choice is to let them couple exactly the way that they couple within each cluster, each quantum dot. So this coupling is also random, and it pretty much looks the same as this one. So you can think of it as a marginal deformation of the critical point defined on a single dot. And this marginal deformation is going to connect different sites. So this way, you really get an incoherent metal with some amount of transport. Things can go across different sites. But interestingly, it's not the single fermion that can hop between different clusters, different quantum dots. As you remember, the Green's function calculated on as each single quantum dot localized even on a site. So nothing really, no single fermion can go from one site to another. Definitely not from one dot to another dot. So there's no quasi-particle description. And it has a local quantum criticality, as in it only scales in time as a power law, but it has no scaling in space. That's why it's called local quantum criticality. And then, but indeed, since you have already coupled these clusters, these quantum dots, there must be some transport going on, and there's some modes carrying heat and charge, and those are actually highly collective, diffusive mode. They diffuse their bosonic modes, and they can only diffuse across these different clusters, giving rise to non-trivial transport. Yeah.
When you say SYK inter-dot coupling, you mean
just
between two nearest dots?
That's right. Yeah. But whether or not it's nearest, it doesn't really matter a lot.
What is your dimension? Do you now have a dimension once you have a cluster, or still don't have a cluster?
You can have an array of quantum dots in any dimension. For example, you can put it on a square lattice, cubic lattice, or even higher dimension. Uh-huh. And then you just couple these dots using these random...
But it will be nearest neighbor.
You can, say the simplest choice would be just letting the nearest neighbor quantum dots interact with each other. Yeah.
In the charge transfer, you only allow pair hopping, or you allow single fermion hopping?
Yeah, so when I say SYK for inner dot, I mean that I want this, you can think of them as pair hopping. So only the thing that connects different dots are also these four fermion terms. They took exactly the
same. Bagel on one, and the non-bagel one on
this subject to a choice, but pretty much it's not going to change the phenomenology a lot. So you can have like one dagger here, one dagger here, and two non-daggers, or you can have a Cooper pair hopping, or you can have dagger non-dagger and dagger non-dagger here. I mean, you can have different choices, but it's not going to change the qualitative behavior very much. Yes.
Will you be still working with infinite n?
Yes. So large n is always very important in terms of solving these problems.
He's summarizing what's in those papers. Say what he'll do.
Yeah. Not that. so these are, I'm just, giving you a sort of a first attempt, people trying to, build something really with metallic transport, diffusive metallic transport using the SYK clusters, SYK quantum dots.
And maybe you
should
speed up.
Yeah. That's right. Yes. So this is our model. We took a different choice. You may think that it's actually a simpler choice than what was done previously. We have a SYK quantum dot. Like you can put it in an array in any dimension. We only want to consider random hopping between them. But okay, I called it SYK to inner dot coupling. It's just the random hopping term. So in terms of Hamiltonian, it looks like that. This localizes on a single each dot, and then this connects neighboring dot, for example. And then, the C's carries the mode index and the spatial index, okay? And then all these couplings are just random variables with zero mean, and then they have their variance is given this way. They're just Gaussian random variables, but this U naught and T naught sets the energy scale of the problem, and they scale in N in this way.
The copy is short range.
Yeah, so for example, I can choose just the nearest neighbor hopping. Yeah. And then the region of interest is the following. So we're going to consider the limit where this thing is pretty huge and let temperature well beneath this energy scale, and then also let the hopping to be well beneath this first term. Because we want to make the best out of the SYK incoherentness, SYK4 incoherentness in the system. Right. Okay, so I'm just rewriting the Hamiltonian here. And the way to do it, you have a disorder system, so the most straightforward way is to do replica trick, and then you do disorder averaging. But thanks to the amazing property of this model, which I'm not going to explain, you can actually take the replica diagonal ansatz in this model. So after the disorder average, I'm gonna let every single copies of replica to be exactly the same. So all these fields, now I'm writing down the imaginary time field theory, and it doesn't, for every C operator, or C field, there's a mode index, there's a spatial index, there's a time index, but there's no replica index. So this is some theory that look like that. Well, this just is the kinetic term. And then this is the interaction given by averaging over the four fermion interaction, so you get something like an A fermion term. It's pretty complicated. And this is coming out of averaging the T. So So you get it from two fermion into a four fermion term. And also, because these are quench disorders, and now you end up with a path integral with two times, because these disorder, these random couplings are infinitely correlated along the time direction. They're just like quench disorder. Yes?
SYK2 is not self-averaging. So why is your model self-averaging?
Well, the large N limit makes it that you can, if you take N first, you can always take the saddle point. That's not going to hurt the discussion.
You can, but depending on SYK2 or 4 or 6, that's sufficiently higher than 1 over N. It stops being self-averaging. And you get a different answer than you would have gotten with fixed.
You're saying that at higher orders in N, right? Yeah, so right now I'm not going to talk about higher loops in 1 over N.
Yeah, but for SYK2, mm-hmm. that higher order is already 1 over N, which you won't be talking about.
But I also have this pretty big SYK4 term.
That's right.
So yeah, I don't have a very definite answer to that, but I think that what we get, it eventually makes a lot of sense. So
does it rely on the assumption that U is dominant?
Does it rely on the assumption? I guess if I just remove this term, what he mentioned will probably show up. But yeah, you can say that maybe it's relying on the fact that I have a random four fermion couplings in here.
But even in the opposite limit, it recovers standard results of random matrix theory.
That's right, yeah.
There's no...
Yeah. So, okay. So this is a pretty complicated theory, but I'm not going to, solve it for you. I mean, at least in real time. But, you know, there are some simple things you can do, which is that you can at least do some scaling analysis first. So now you have this horrible looking like A fermion terms, but you know that this term, if you only have this term, this is what gives you the local quantum criticality. And once you have some criticality, you can talk about scaling dimensions and all that. And now, if you look at this term, you have two times, and it just basically tell you that all these C's has a scaling dimension of 1/4. Now remember, I'm scaling only along the time direction, not the spatial dimension. So this term is exactly marginal by the choice, especially when I set this thing to zero. And then now we start to turn this on and see what's going on, and also include the effect of this thing. Of course, this is set to be marginal by my requirement. This term is always irrelevant by the scaling, but this term is relevant. But, nevertheless, so this is going to dominate the low energy physics, but still, if this term is small, it takes some time for this thing to develop a sizable impact on the low energy physics. And by the scaling argument, you can actually figure out a coherent energy scale where this thing starts to get important. And this coherent scale is what I call EC, that is T squared over U. And this will be a very important energy scale. And well above this energy scale, things is going to be dominated by this term. And well below the scale, things is going to be dominated by this term. And eventually, when this thing dominates the low energy physics, you're going to get whatever the SYK2 Fermi liquid. Yeah, you're going to get the SYK2 Fermi liquid behavior. Right. Okay. That's some scaling analysis. But the real method to solve these things is to introduce this dynamical mean field. It's actually just the dynamical mean field theory that you basically think of the CC bilinear as a bosonic variable. In fact, it is just indeed the Green's function of the fermions. And then you enforce this relation by a Lagrange multiplier, which I call sigma. And then later you will notice that this thing is actually carrying the meaning of self-energy. But the point is, the important point is when you introduce this dynamical mean field, you can substitute the C dagger C by this G field. So this A fermion term will be gone, and you can substitute it with something like G to the power 4. And this is something like G squared. So ultimately, you end up with something that consists of mostly these bosonic fields, G and sigma.
saying this is sort of like a saddle point solution?
This is exactly the saddle point solution. So I'm introducing a mean field, and I'm going to take the saddle point of this mean field. And it turns out that in the large N limit, this saddle point is infinitely stable, stabilized by the large N. So if you do the substitution, there will be an N hanging out in front that stabilizes the mean field. And also, you can take the ansatz where the G, the Green's function, doesn't depend on where the cluster is, and also it's translationally invariant in time. And now you get this two saddle point equation. The first just basically telling you that, okay, G is the Green's function, sigma is the self-energy. And the self-energy has some expression that depends on SYK4 term, SYK2 term.
Is there a unique way to decouple it? Because you might think there might be C-dagger-C-dagger correlators. Why do you only look at C-dagger-C?
So this model is ultimately charge conserved. So yeah, for C-dagger-C, you really need like the development of superconductivity for that to happen.
But I don't know what's
and also,
and yeah, sorry. U has both sides, right?
Yeah, and also, there's this counting. You know, there's an n cube in here. So if you choose to consider like C-dagger correlation function, there's a summation that I didn't write explicitly, but those terms will be suppressed by powers of n. So.
Index, it has to be paired up, right?
Yeah, so.
Pair an I with an I to get the proper large N limit.
That's right, yeah.
Ultimately, it comes down to the choice of correlations you took for this U, for this random interaction.
I thought there were no correlations in the U.
If you had Majorana fermions, there'd be absolutely no correlations with complex fermions. You have, you know, not all the indices are the same. There are two indices that are with daggers and two with non-daggers.
I see.
And so certain averages.
So basically, this is the only choice of dynamical mean field that gives you something when you decompose all these, have a power of n in the front. That's the leading in n term. And of course, other terms might show up, but in higher orders of 1 over n. Okay? Right. And then there are two terms. So, I mean, for each of these are just simple saddle point equation, although just within this form, you cannot solve it analytically for every single fixed temperature, but at least we can solve it on a computer by, you know, discretizing, by going into finite temperature and having, like, you know, discrete Matsubara frequencies. Yeah. And then what we see is basically that at high temperature, this term is going to dominate. It's basically telling you that at higher temperature, this thing is not so important. And then you recover this SYK4 local quantum criticality, which is consistent with what our scaling says. And then at lower temperature, this thing is going to kick in and become more and more important and let the SYK2 physics dominate. Right. Okay. So these are some understanding of the Green's function, which is useful. What is more interesting is the thermodynamical property of this model, because now we have a field theory, we found a saddle point, we can go ahead to, you know, plug the saddle point back in and calculate partition functions and thermodynamical quantities. What we are interested in here is the entropy, for example, is a thermodynamical quantity, so it can be directly obtained once you have the mean field. And interestingly, we now are, well, these are coming out of a numerical calculation of the saddle point and then, you know, plugging it back. So now I'm plotting the entropy as a function of temperature, but now I rescale the temperature with this coherent energy scale EC. And these different shapes are calculations done for different ratios of T0 and U0. So you see that all of these calculations collapse on a single universal curve, which is pretty amazing. That tells you that the entropy can be written in this form. Of course, it's proportional to n. And then it has a universal function that depends only on this ratio, T over this dimensionless temperature, T over EC. So everything collapses onto this curve which determines this thing. And then at zero temperature, we said that it's going to recover the SYK2 physics, so it has a zero temperature entropy, which is good. And then Once T gets big, say, starts to get bigger than EC, it starts to notice the SYK4 physics. It shoots up very quickly, and then it starts to cross over to this value, which is given exactly by the zero temperature entropy of the SYK4 model. So this curve is pretty natural. This dotted line is basically telling you where what the value of the SYK4 zero temperature entropy is. Okay. So we see some amazing collapse here, and then we can try to pull more things out of it. For example, we can look at the Sommerfeld coefficient, which is defined by this, it's dS dT at zero temperature. Since we have this universal behavior, it's going to depend on some derivative. Well, this is about some derivative of the universal function, which is just a number, presumably it's order 1. But interestingly, it just have a 1 over EC dependence in here. This is the Sommerfeld coefficient that is related to entropy and as well related to the specific heat as well. And there's also a very important quantity, which is the charge compressibility, which is that, how the charge depends on the chemical potential. Presumably, when I said U is to be the largest, the most dominant energy scale, K is going to be some, well, actually some order 1 number over U naught anyway. Then, with this two, we can actually recover, try to recover the Landau interaction parameter, which is basically given by gamma over K. Okay, so in the Landau Fermi liquid theory, gamma over K should be this combination. F is the Landau interaction parameter. And now, gamma over K, using our understanding here, is something like U naught over T naught squared. So, in the regime where we're working in, this is a pretty large number, much larger than 1. That means the interaction parameter is pretty large. And hence, it's a highly renormalized Fermi liquid at low temperature.
We have about 5 minutes of discussion time left.
Ah. Okay. Yeah, so, right, I will try to be brief, like, since... So far, this is for a thermodynamical property. And then, for a to understand this thing better, we also not only want to understand the thermodynamical property, but also the transport property. But studying transport, and especially at finite temperature, doing it just at imaginary time is not adequate, especially if we want to do imaginary time calculation and do time analytic continuation. Having only understanding the numerical solution is definitely not enough. So we're going to do some real-time formalism. But I guess given the time constraint, I won't tell you really how I do it. But instead, it's just doing a Kaldish contour, path integral, and do disorder average, and introduce this dynamical mean field again. But now the dynamical mean field will be Green's functions in real time, and also depends on the choice of contour. So there are just multiple Green's functions involved. That plays the major role in the field theory. So some field theory that looks like this will show up, and then again you can go through this exercise to find the saddle point solution of the dynamical mean field and the self energy, and then in fact these things also are basically the familiar retarded advance and the Kaldish-Green's function that we are used to. And the temperature dependence is, of course, should be consistent with what we expect from the scaling analysis. Right. Okay. So Green's function we understand now, but more importantly, we want to understand transport. So transport relies on, because now we don't have any quasi-particles, so understanding transport is presumably a pretty complicated business. But right now, since we know that the only conserved quantity in the system is only charge and energy, so we know that there must be a way, or there may be a way, to focus on those fluctuations only. So charge and energy fluctuations are what we're after. And then, based on previous work, we know that actually, to capture these charge and energy fluctuations, we only have to just to find the right variables to capture them. For example, for U1, you just have to do a time-dependent location-dependent phase rotation and see how the phase fluctuation pan out in this model. The way to do it is basically take the saddle point, you do the variation according to the say the U1 rotation, and then just try to write out a quadratic theory for the phase fluctuation. So I won't go through in detail, but eventually you will arrive something like a quadratic term of the phase fluctuation, for example, when you do U1, when you care about U1 charge. And this quadratic theory of phi, interestingly, has a diffusion pole. If you look at this part more carefully, the diffusion pole basically reads out like I omega equals minus d p squared. So this is what you expect when you have a hydrodynamical theory and some diffusive mode. So the d is the diffusion constant. Then the prefactor here is in fact the charge compressibility. Then using Einstein relation, if you know this and this, you basically know the electric conductivity sigma. You can do the similar thing for energy. What's conjugate to energy is basically time translation. So now I want to do a spatial dependent translation of time and then see what can come out. And then you can get the thermal conductivity also using the Einstein relationship, just like what we did in the U1 case. So I guess this is this and the last slide. So I'm going to show you this plot. This plot is basically, now I'm drawing the resistivity, not the conductivity, as a function of temperature. Temperature is rescaled by EC, and there are these different shapes in the plot. They represent calculations with different values, different choices of T0 and U0. You see some universal behavior, which is nice. And also you see that there are some linear relation between the resistivity and the temperature. And in fact, this is actually a high temperature behavior. So at high temperature, all the resistivity goes linear in T. At low temperature, they actually have a quadratic curve. As in low temperature, you actually get a constant plus some T-squared behavior. This is what you expect when, for Fermi liquid, when the most dominant mechanism of resistivity is just electron-electronic interactions. So again, this behavior is basically confirms the fact that the low energy behavior is a Fermi liquid. And also, there's this amazing plot that is...
Something we really need to get to the conclusion.
Yes, so this is... Yeah. So this is the last thing. And then also, as you can see, this is the Lorentz ratio versus temperature. So we know that for Fermi liquid, it should be pi squared over 3. And in fact, at low temperature, it is that value. And then at high temperature, it becomes something like a pi squared over 8. That is definitely something not Fermi liquid-like. That basically indicates an incoherent matter behavior. So that's all I want to talk about today.
We already asked a lot of questions, which was part of the reason why I was a little more forgiving than usual.
Sorry.
You know me. But maybe a couple more, just a couple more questions, and we can carry the conversation to coffee break. Any more questions?
So, saying that this is...
I choose to get the question. Very controlling.
Sorry.
Lucille first.
So is there a difference in the high temperature regime, whether it was a SYK2 that was coupling the dots or an SYK4 that coupling the dots in the transport in particular?
Yeah, so if you have SYK4 intra and also intercluster, in terms of scaling, they scale the same way, so they pretty much don't have a lot of temperature dependence. And it's really because that, you know, if you say let the start from the critical point defined by the SYK4, you notice that this is actually a relevant deformation of the model. Now you notice that as you change temperature, you will start to explore this at low temperature and this at high temperature. But if both scales the same way, then there's just basically no competition between them.
And the low temperature behavior, if you didn't have the U term at all?
If I don't have that, okay.
Just the random hopping between?
Yeah.
What would it look like?
What would it look like? So, well, I would say that it just looks like a normal, like, disordered metal, diffusive, if you take the large N limit first. Yeah.
That would be diffusion.
But of course, we can debate on whether you work with finite N at 1D, you will get a localization or not, but that's a different question. Yeah.
Awesome. Okay,
if you
So, the single dot doesn't have any large in a single ground state, right? It has a generic manifold of ground state, and somehow this...
Oh, you mean if I take the large N limit first?
You take the large N limit, right? So the hopping is lifting this degeneracy and giving you a unique ground state. Do you have any idea how the ground state should look like?
Should look like...
Is this a way of writing such a ground state?
Eventually, if you work the other way around, it should be pretty straightforward. As in, if you start with the random hopping, you just get a bunch of levels, and then you fill it up to some point, that's the Fermi level, and then the interaction doesn't destabilize this picture as you go.
I don't think you should think of it as a ground state degeneracy. It's just that the entropy over N in the limit N to infinity at any non-zero temperature is constant. But if you take any fixed N, what's actually happening is the level spacing is exponentially small, even at low energy density.
Right, but that gets lifted through
some power law.
That gets lifted by the hopping, right?
The hopping turns it into a Fermi liquid where at low energies the level spacing is actually power law in the system science. That's what the low energy states of a Fermi liquid are quasi-particle like, so kind of a plane wave whose the number of those plane wave states is 1 over n, more or less. That's a kind of characteristic of any interval system, low number of low energy states.
Okay, so the question is the way to describe those quasi-particles. The quasi-particles of the low energy of the Fermi liquid are highly dressed.
They're certainly highly dressed, guys. They're very heavy. It's an effective mass. It's a factor of U over T bigger than the bare band mass. They have this strong interaction. So.
Okay.
So kind of two related questions, or same question, different angles. None of what you talked about seems to depend on dimensionality.
Mm-hmm.
And the other, and from a different side, you had diffusion poles and diffusion transport.
Yes.
In a sort of strongly disordered system, where you have just, the Fermi liquid term also is strongly disordered. Is this just a feature of the large N, or?
Yeah, I think so.
And can you connect that up?
So, for example, if you do a disordered metal and then you always work at a situation where you have an infinitely large Fermi surface, then you always get diffusion. But if you care about finite N, and it's a much more complicated story, and then there might be some non-perturbative stuff going on that is not captured by this large N solution.
And do you have any idea what happens with the 1 over N corrections?
Not really, sorry.
This large N limit, as far as localization goes, is almost the same as the standard large N limits that are used to study localization in non-interacting systems. So there's people alternatively talking about large KFL. It basically is equivalent to large KFL. You can also think of it in terms of these flavors. You have as many sites in a dot. Look at the hopping, that's maybe the easiest way to think about it. So hopping is all to all. You can hop from any orbital on the first dot to any orbital on the next dot. So in a localization theory, the localization is caused by constructive interference between backscattering paths. But since you can hop from one orbital to any other orbital, the first kind of nominal backscattering path is going from orbital I here to orbital J, and orbital J here will typically come back to orbital K. To actually get an interference correction, you have to have the improbable event that you hop back to the same orbital I, and that's down by a factor of 1 over n. That's basically why in the Larghan limit you don't get localization corrections. Literally in diagrammatics, it's the same suppression you see in large span file, you see in absorption of signal models.
More questions? One last, very last question, yes.
Maybe the naive, but what happens if we have intra SYK2 and inter SYK4?
Sorry. Oh, intra SYK2 and inter SYK4.
Flip into.
Yeah, we actually have a different model that has that thing, but it's on a different work of mine with Senku and Jin here. And so yeah, that model will have a different behavior because you know that by scaling analysis, SYK2, whatever form it takes, gonna win in low temperature. So in that situation, the SYK2 is only localizing on one single site, so never contribute to transport. And the things that connect to different dots are irrelevant. So you can already guess that at low temperatures it won't conduct. So it's an interesting situation, but it won't be a metal at low temperature.
Right. On that note, we should end the official talk, but he'll be around. And anybody interested can continue the discussion. I just want to pose it on everybody else's schedule, respect the schedule that's posted. So let's thank Chongming again.